Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The notion of didactic art has been both lauded by the ancient Greeks as a powerful educational technique and dismissed by 19th century romantics as overburdened with facticity and morality. In recent decades, however, didactic films and videos have been utilized in both satire and earnest within art spaces as a subversive tool to acutely observe and diagnose the conditions of contemporary life. In this lecture, as part of the Works in Progress series on September 9, 2019, Zach Feldman considers this tool in select nonfiction instructional videos by filmmakers and artist Haroun Faraki and Hito Steril.
Artist Hito Steril and graduate director of the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard College, Maria Lind, write that documentaries have historically emerged as a means to demarcate moments of social crisis, alluding to a distrust in the digitally born image to represent reality. Steril and Lind connect a dissatisfaction with digital photographic indexicality to the upsurge of artistic production engaged with documentary images since the early 2000s. For many years before this, art and documentary were commonly understood as antithetical or antagonistic, even relegating documentary to the, quote, opposite of art, its alter ego, end quote. Without going into the minutiae of this transformation and the appropriation of documentary into the realm of art, there are three interrelated influencers that allowed this acceptance, the first being the proclaimed death of cinema at the centennial of the medium in 1995, shifting capital for funding creators from the television and film industry more towards gallery commissions. This is a point we'll return to later. And was really cemented by Documenta 11 in 2001 and the 50th Venice Biennale in 2003. Within both artistic production and curatorial practice, there's been a privileging of documentary images and archive building since the late 1980s and early 90s, cemented by the early 2000s art festivals that I mentioned, Documenta 11 and the 50th Venice Biennale. The precarity experienced by the film industry in the early 90s in response to digital capture and alternate viewing methods led to a diaspora of moving image arts and eventually towards institutional acceptance of film installations and other moving artworks within the confines of designated museum and gallery spaces. Haroun Faraki, a multi-hyphenate filmmaker, author, theorist, wrote a 1992 article titled Reality Would Have to Begin, in which he investigates the history of aerial reconnaissance photography and tells the story of aerial photographs of the Auschwitz camps and gas chambers captured by the Allied forces. These photographs, however, were only rediscovered far after the end of the war in the late 1970s, when a U.S. intelligence officer was so moved by the fictional television series Holocaust that he remembered having once seen photographs of the camp in a Pentagon filing cabinet. It took a fictional television program to bring to light this documentary evidence. Reality and fiction are intimately intertwined. This is a case of art of life imitating art imitating life. Film scholar Thomas Alassier, in a 2017 retrospective article about Faraki, points to what he believes are five preoccupations in Faraki's oeuvre. They are as follows: representation and reproduction, which is the questioning of the assumption that reality can, in fact, be represented through the reproduction of its image. And one might think back to Walter Benjamin's famous artwork in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction essay in this context. Operational images, which are Faraki's kind of claim to fame. He's one of the first to realize the potential of the image, the potential of images that serve no ostensible aesthetic or communicative purpose in the traditional sense of film, but rather these images point to a new definition of what an image is and what an image does. They're often found, can be taken from science experiments, technological training for machine learning, medical films, surveillance, or industrial and instructional films, as we'll talk about today. They originate from training, testing, experimentation, monitoring, and recording phenomena not visible to the naked eye. This is this image down here is a great example of an operational image. It's a photograph from, it's a still from the series War at a Distance. A robot camera is learning to maneuver through the hallways of a science building. It's recognizing, using machine learning to recognize a junction where two hallways intersect. Farocki is not alone in connecting the history of the photographic medium to aerial reconnaissance and warfare. But what makes him unique in his interpretation of surveillance and military is how he combines military surveillance with his other insights to enlighten how operational images and simulation create scenarios of seeing and being seen in both reality and in the game. This film, again, War at a Distance, is full of these images. Maybe the most shocking are cameras embedded on the noses of bombs, suicide cameras, as he calls them. Simulation and role play are very important and to Farocki's understanding of the operational image. Both simulation and role play give us a window of insight into the activities of daily lives, of daily life, as well as peripheral tasks. Through repetition and role play, people appear as actors playing themselves. And in this way, the act of training is this analogous to taking up new acting roles. This is essential to the context behind instructional videos. Lastly, for Farocki, labor of invisibility and the invisibility of labor. Invisibility is not simply an absence for Farocki, but rather something that is actively produced. And this idea is very important to Hito Steyerl, who we'll return to towards the end of this lecture. In an age of photography and other image-capturing devices, the oversaturation of quote-unquote vision machines creates a commodity out of the privilege to be invisible. The idea of the right to be forgotten movement comes to mind here in the contemporary debate on data collection. In this lecture today, I hope to expand on some of the occupations in Farocki's works, particularly the works pertaining to training images. This is training for social behavior, for manual labor, and for the tasks of machines, and to demonstrate how this legacy has continued to influence prominent media artists in their approach to creating art that responds to human-machine interaction, labor, and the surveillance of military and civilians alike. So this image is a still from the third part of a four-part film installation called Serious Games. It's a two-screen installation, and what we're seeing here on the right screen is a photo capture of what he is seeing in his virtual reality helmet. We're led to believe at first, in this, it's about an 8 or 10 minute clip, we're led to believe that this man is relaying his experience in warfare that led to PTSD in front of a therapist and a programmer, a game programmer, who's actively changing the scenarios in the games to reflect his story. However, little spoiler, at the end, we find out that he is not, in fact, at all a soldier, but he is a representative of the company that's marketing and selling this product to the U.S. military. So the role play here is kind of doubled. What Farocki so brilliant reveals, what so brilliantly reveals to us, are the layers upon layers of performativity that are built into the activities of therapy, marketing, and daily life. So these are the two films that I'll be talking about mostly today in regards to Farocki, Leben Beade, or How to Live in the German Federal Republic, and The Interview. Both of these films are comprised of scenes of training and durability. How to Live demonstrates a type of training required to acclimate to a particular social lifestyle at the very beginning of German reunification. So we can see that this film is made in 1990, so really at the cusp of German reunification. The people are trained and tested, whether it's in the course of how to assist in birthing, how to kill people, therapy, or simply driving and learning how to cross the street. 1996 marks Farocki's first foray into his many video installations. As I mentioned before, the mid-1990s provided conditions for the perfect storm of filmmakers transitioning into new roles as artists and creating works for the galleries, and in some ways forced this transition upon the producers. The kind of films that Farocki was making were uniquely positioned for their display in the gallery, and the drying up of funds for television and film programming pushed producers into the realm of art, which was perhaps more willing to accept the work of avant-garde filmmakers. However, the battle for the full acceptance of documentary in the art realm was not quite finished. Farocki did pave a path for this acceptance and has influenced many prominent artists, filmmakers, photographers, ranging from Hito Steirl, who, again, I'll speak about shortly, Christian Petzold, and Trevor Paglen. Important to note that in these two films of Farocki, Leben, or How to Live, and The Interview, neither of them contain any kind of expository voiceover. All of the narrative is pushed forward through these kinds of shot juxtapositions. And some scenes are almost nonsensical or seem very out of place, but they're always put in conversation with others that seem to make a story or a narrative out of them. This is a prime example. German media theorist Dietrich Leder wrote about this film, quote, "It is a play in the theater of life made up of training courses, fitness tests for things and people. The real mechanical ballet is not danced by machines, but by people who move to a music that feeds on bombastic phrases from the realms of social work, bureaucracy, and therapy. Altogether, the collected scenes appear to support the view that the mentality of insurance and providing for the future and the FRG, a country in which happiness as well as misery are supposed to be disciplined by means of social techniques and freed from any measure of unpredictability," end quote. Alassier writes that this film documents how role play, things are role-played, test-driven, sampled, and rehearsed for emergency situations. It is as if we are keeping life itself at a safe distance, consistently asking for field manuals of how to live our lives, as well as how to conduct wars, fall in love, or stress test our bodies, end quote. As much as this film has to do with the tongue-in-cheek instruction of life in West Germany, its title is, after all, How to Live. It is also a film about the uncovering of labor usually unseen. That is, the labor of performativity, in a sense of Judith Butler, perhaps, through the action of cinematic capture. It also merges human subjectivity in a capitalist society and the inanimate objectivity of things through their capacities to produce utility. And in this conversation about producing utility, this is at the heart of the second film we'll investigate, Farocki's second film, The Interview. Now, you may ask yourself at the beginning of this clip, this kind of mundane conversation, it's damn hot, you'd probably wish you'd rather be swimming. Why would anybody want to watch that? But it's this kind of mundane exchange and how to shake hands, how to properly conduct yourself in an interview. That is exactly the point of this film. And I'll go back a couple slides and show you a screen capture from this moment where an instructor is teaching her students how best to negotiate your salary. And her strategy is saying very flatly, this amount, that's my price, that's what you can have me for. I'm selling myself, selling my utility to the job. Now, those being trained for the jobs in this film are high school dropouts, university graduates, recovering drug addicts, and mid-level managers. They're all being trained to market and sell themselves in a way that probably all of us are familiar with. There's a moment towards the end of the film where there's an exchange between this man and the woman he's interviewing. In this image on the right, the blue-tinted image, he's asking her during the mock interview about her salary expectations. The blue tint, as we also saw in the previous clip, is indicative of a teaching moment. It's yet another cinematic grammatical structure set up by Farocchi in lieu of any expository voiceover. And it's often in conjunction with that kind of Neil Young guitar riff. Funnily enough, it's the same music from Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man. So he's asking her, this woman who wants to interview for a commissions-based sales job, why she believes she should earn as much as she has claimed. And when she doubles down and says she's committed to the job, she's committed to the industry, and his response is that, well, in capitalism, it doesn't matter. It's all about profit. What can you bring in at the end of the day? I don't care how committed you are to this job. This claim, it seems kind of crass, but perhaps realistic. It falls apart a little bit when a little bit later on we understand that he himself would not want to work such a job. That he kind of reveals his Marxist-Leninist predilections and believes that does not believe that only profits should matter in this way. Steyerl is one of Farocchi's most prominent students, and her use of the instructional video format in this example is done to a similar effect, but with quite divergent formal qualities as the two videos that we've seen by Farocchi so far. Unlike Farocchi's instructional videos at hand today, Steyerl does use a voiceover rather than editing techniques alone to explain her theory. She satirically describes the methods one could employ to capitalize on the commodity of invisibility, which in this case is really privacy. It's also important to note that this is one of, or perhaps the only video by Steyerl that is available and accessible entirely online. And I think this is done to emphasize the PSA, the public service announcement, or instructional quality of the video. It does derive its name from a famous Monty Python skit, which is done under the guise of Her Majesty's public service announcement on the values of how not to be seen. Steyerl is known for her use of puns and humor in her work. Her latest book, Duty Free Art, plays on the double meaning of duty in that it means both tax and obligation. Her video takes from Monty Python's in both its appearance and the introductory screens. They look very similar, as well as its use of humorous satire and a voiceover. Although in Steyerl's, it's a seemingly automated, droning voice. The appropriation of the PSA formats in both of these videos increases its level of irony and humor. Giles' first lesson in this didactic film states her main thesis. Resolution is the currency of visibility.
The most important things want to remain invisible. Love is invisible. War is invisible. Capital is invisible.
In the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. Air Force installed grayscales and resolution targets in the California desert to calibrate aerial photographs and videos. Resolution determines visibility. It calibrates the world as a picture.
The droning voices that alternate between male and female in this video give a number of humorous ways how to not be seen that include hiding in plain sight, shrinking down to a unit smaller than a pixel, living in a gated community, being in an airport or a museum, or being female and over 50. In a world of photographs, everything is calibrated according to the old standards of military aerial photography for surveillance and reconnaissance. Yet Steyerl pushes back on the notion that digitality necessarily equals higher visibility and convenience. She seems to pose the questions, can pixels be trusted the way that grains of silver dust on a piece of photoemulsion can? Can grains of silver dust be trusted after all? An automated female voice reads later on in the video, in the decades of the digital revolution, 1,700 people disappear. Disappeared people are annihilated, eliminated, eradicated, deleted, dispensed with, filtered, processed, selected, separated, wiped out. One must ask at this point if the voice is still talking about disappeared people or about the ontology of digital media itself. In the oversaturation of images, a world of images as it's named here, digital images are not superior to their analog forefathers and instead pose new and unique sets of challenges. Steyerl's video follows Ferrucchi's in that they both provide an ontology for the image which no longer represents a reality or truth of any kind, instead taking the lead in the construction of reality itself. Resolution determines visibility. Photographs construct reality. Pics or it didn't happen. The task of instructional videos that one may have seen in school on noisy 16mm projectors or VHS TV combos are not a throwaway medium simply because they've evaded the categorization of high art. Instruction is the prerequisite to performativity and has become a staple in the grammar of moving image artwork at the tail end of when television documentary industry was still viable and now for the gallery and other means of exhibition. Performativity is center to our daily lives and is not something out there or beyond ourselves. The genre of instructional films, satirical or otherwise, demands to be taken seriously and to be considered for its existence as artifacts of social behaviors, critiques of political and economic systems, for the effectiveness to reveal the layers of simulation and reproduction in almost all human activities. Thank you for coming to my talk.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.